Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are blessed to have the intelligence each week of one of the most intelligent men I know, particularly on the matter in which he is deeply knowledgeable, the Chinese Communist Party and the country that it misrules. His name is Gordon Chang. He's the author of numerous terrific books, including The Coming Collapse of China and The Great U.S.-China Tech War. He is a pundit extraordinaire. You see him often at Fox and in other outlets, including ours, of course. And he is to be followed. It is absolutely mandatory at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon, it is so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
I had several things I wanted to touch on with you quickly in this short block we have with you. The first is that you have written an ominous piece, I think it's fair to say, in Newsweek entitled China is Becoming a Military State. Now, for those of us who've been worried about what the Chinese Communist Party is up to for some time, it's been bad enough that it was a communist totalitarian state. What does it mean if indeed the military is now taking a more and more prominent and influential role?
It means that flag officers are now not only determining external policies, but also, I think, they're having influence on civilian matters as well. Amendments to China's National Defense Law, which became effective the first of this year, gives the Communist Party's Central Military Commission sweeping powers. And these powers take away from the State Council, which is the Chinese central government. Another aspect of this law involves mobilization. It appears that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, is trying to get the Chinese people ready for mass mobilization, and that's perhaps for war.
Well, it's not only that sort of indirect sign. He's actually calling for the military to be ready for war, at, I think you said the other day, any second. So we're not simply inferring from what he's up to, it's pretty much declared policy, it seems, as well, right?
Well, certainly. And now there are Chinese soldiers deep into Indian-controlled territory in Ladakh. There have been Chinese encroachments last year in Bhutan and Nepal. And indeed, China's trying to expand its borders. We all know about its peripheral seas, and it's now laying the basis for additional territorial claims against Russia, against Japan, against Tajikistan. And of course, the Chinese military has been engaging in these threatening maneuvers directed at Taiwan.
All of this is against the backdrop, of course, of having a new administration in Washington, one that I believe has, at least in the person of Donald Trump and arguably Kamala Harris too, been deeply compromised by the Chinese Communist Party. Gordon, yet we saw the inaugural committee of the Biden administration invite officially the representative from Taiwan to attend, my first, I believe, since 1979. How much should we read into that, and how much do you think it will help deter China from what it may have in mind in the way of war for with the people of Taiwan?
This is an important step forward, Frank. During the Trump administration, we saw an expansion of official ties between Washington and Taipei, and many people were concerned that the Biden administration would stop that. But with invitation to Taiwan's representative in Washington to the inaugural, it is a sign to Beijing that the United States will stand with another democracy. And this is one of the best things from yesterday.
And do you think that would be a correct reading of what the Biden policy will be, given sort of the personnel that we've seen staffing it up?
I tend to think so, Frank, but this is largely to be written. There are some people in the Biden team who have some very good views about China. But also, we've got to be concerned about John Kerry, the climate czar. And it's been reported that Kerry believes that the climate crisis is so catastrophic that it should take precedence over national security concerns. And indeed, if Kerry does get his way, then we're going to have a reversal of some very important defenses that the Trump administration put in place, including these initiatives on Taiwan that we just talked about. There's going to be a battle royal, I'm sure, at the top of the Biden administration, and I don't know if we have any indication of how that will turn out.
Boy, I hope so, because it if otherwise it just winds up throwing in with the Chinese Communist Party, it's going to be a very dark day for, well, not just our country, I believe, but for the free world, as you've done more to articulate than anybody, Gordon Chang. Lastly, and in this same vein, we did hear statements from Tony Blinken, who will be the Secretary of State, evidently, and Janet Yellen, who will be the Secretary of the Treasury. Some encouraging words to those of us who have long decried what the Chinese Communist Party is doing to the enslaved people of various captive nations, notably in this case, the Uyghur Muslims of East Turkestan, also known in China as Xinjiang. Talk about what they've said, Gordon, and a glimmer of hope that there might be a genuine bipartisan policy in this regard.
On Tuesday, then-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo issued a statement that declared that China was engaging in crimes against humanity against the Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities. And then he specifically said that those crimes include genocide. Just right after that, Tony Blinken, who is Biden's pick to be the next Secretary of State, said that he agreed with that determination. And this was in response to a question from Lindsey Graham during the confirmation hearings. If you go back to the Biden campaign in August, it did issue a statement that called what China was doing in Xinjiang a genocide. So this seems to be a consistent theme in the Biden team. We'll have to see if it has any practical consequences, because it seems to me that we cannot have robust relations with a genocidal regime. And I hope that the Biden team actually imposes costs on China for engaging in these atrocities.
Well, as I understand it, Gordon, there are certain obligations under international law if a nation or some group is engaged in genocidal activity. So this has been one of the reasons why people have been reluctant to invoke that term, is that there are binding obligations. And as with you, I'm very hopeful that this will indeed guide the Biden administration as it deals with China. It also conjures up something we talked about earlier in the hope that it might be something that Donald Trump would do before he left office. He did not, namely designating the Chinese Communist Party as the transnational criminal organization it is. This statement by Tony Blinken and, as I say, Janet Yellen and the campaign before that might well serve as a basis for a designation by the Biden administration to designate, as I say, the Chinese Communist Party as the transnational criminal organization it is. I'm hopeful, but not holding my breath. This is something we will return to with you, Gordon Chang, in the near future. In the meantime, thank you so much for your time today and for the great work that you do in educating all of us at the Gatestone Institute, Fox News, and not least here at Secure Freedom Radio. We'll look forward to doing so more in the weeks ahead. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk to you soon. Next up, we'll visit with Todd Benzman of the Center for Immigration Studies about the Biden effect on immigration and what it's likely to mean for you. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and it's a special pleasure to be able to say welcome back to one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. Great national resource on matters involving immigration, particularly of the illegal kind. His name is Todd Benzman these days. He is a senior fellow specializing in national security at the Indispensable Center for Immigration Studies. He brings to his work there a terrific background of intrepid and award-winning journalism and service in the Department of Public Safety in the state of Texas, where he worked with federal, state, and local law enforcement officials trying to manage and protect our country against the threat posed by illegal immigration, particularly across the southern border. Todd Bensman, it's always good to have you back, and welcome. Happy New Year to you, such as it is.
Yeah, glad to be here. Happy New Year.
Day two of the Biden administration. We saw a number of things take place on day one. Not particularly surprising, given what the president had promised in his campaign. But give us a flavor, Todd, if you would, of what are the steps that the president took in his first day in office, with principally, I guess, in the form of executive orders, and their likely implications, as well as the personnel that he has now implementing those policies.
Right. Well, the president is certainly following through on his campaign platform, letting his left wing know that he is going to open the borders completely to illegal immigration. And believe me, the entire universe of aspiring migrants has heard that clarion call, and they will be coming. The first thing out of the gate, even before his first day was out, was he reversed the Trump travel restrictions list, like he promised to do. It's very symbolic, tit for tat kind of thing, because that was one of the very first things that Donald Trump did.
This is the so-called Muslim ban, inaccurately, but that's how it's been branded, yes?
Yeah, I just try not to call it that, because I don't want to dignify.
Rightly so. I just want to make sure people understand what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's right. So that's gone now. And there are all kinds of implications to that. For national security, we're at greater peril now. And then the other thing that he plans to do, I think today, which is his first full day, which would be to propose a broad amnesty to illegally present people, millions of illegally present people inside the United States who got here prior to January 1, 2021. And then a whole host of other kinds of
people. He says that's about 11 million. You say many millions. Is it likely that it's considerably more than he's saying?
Yeah, I mean, the center has estimated that it's probably more in the neighborhood of 20 plus million, twice as many. Is that if it ever comes to fruition, then we'll see how many actually register for it. So it'll be the first time we actually see it.
This is subject to congressional approval?
That's right. This one's subject to, it's got to go through the process, and probably by the time it ends up on the other side of the meat grinder, it'll look somewhat different. Or if it may not pass at all, we just don't know with the new Congress. But it doesn't matter, because the message of it to the world is if you can get yourself here, eventually you'll get legalized. We'll legalize you eventually in this one or some other one, or in any of a half a dozen of other kinds of amnesty programs that are at the president's disposal. So it's open borders. It's wide open borders. And everybody has heard that.
Including stopping the construction of the proverbial wall as well, making sure that at least a good chunk of that border is going to remain physically open too, right?
Yeah, and ending all deportations. So if you're an illegal who can get yourself over the border, you know you're not going to be deported, even criminals, to include people who've offended drunk driving.
With the murder, perhaps, on their hands. And Todd, you mentioned that there's a nominal end date for this, January 1st, but that in practice doesn't apply, does it, really?
Well, I mean, if January 1st is the date, if you are here by January 1st, which is, a couple of weeks ago, the idea is that people who have long roots in America, who have paid their taxes, have a history of staying out of trouble, would qualify for the path to citizenship. So that means that if you've been here for 3 weeks, you've kind of built up your track record, or how long is a track record good for? A year? Maybe a year. You've been here for a year and you stayed out of trouble. I don't know.
And also, I think isn't your experience that the people lie about when they came?
That's right. If you can manage to get in here and evade Border Patrol and any kind of a record where your fingerprints are attached and kind of get into the interior, it's like, I came in on December 30th. You can backdate. And there are all kinds of problems with this bill. And I hope that in the debates and wrangling that happen from here on, some of that will come out.
Boy, look, I just hope there'll be a debate about this. It seems as though the majority party in both the House and Senate are determined to have their way across a broad front, and we'll see if this is part of their agenda. Todd, let me talk a little bit about one, it seems, outlier on the so-called Biden effect, as I think you're calling it, of open borders serving as kind of a magnet for people coming here. Those who formed up in a caravan in Honduras in recent weeks seem to have come a cropper, thanks to law enforcement and military personnel, I guess, in Guatemala. Does that augur well for the future, or do you think that really is going to prove to be the last gasp of the effort to keep these illegal aliens from getting here pursuant to Donald Trump's policies?
Well, it should be no surprise to anyone that this was probably the biggest caravan in the history of caravans. This thing swelled from about 1,000 or 2,000 in the beginning to, within a couple days, 9,000 people. And the caravan just absolutely plowed violently through Honduran military and initially through Guatemalan border guard and some military as well, and was heavy pell-mell for the Mexican border, except that the Guatemalans put 5,000 troops on the roads and blocked them at a pass, literally headed them off at a pass, and kind of beat them back with batons and tear gas and the rest. My feeling is that today Honduras is now accusing Guatemala of inhumane treatment and is calling for investigations about the way that happened. And then Honduras, its resolve already failed. They practically escorted the caravan after they broke through all the way to the border. So I think we can count Honduras out. And I'm guessing that on the next caravan, we may very well be able to count Guatemala out. And then beyond that is Mexico, because without Trump in office threatening them to take their financial aid and security assistance away or to do trade tariffs, they have no real incentive to stop these caravans. So once
arguably incentives to let them go.
Yeah, right. Pass the hot potato on up north.
And Mexico will do the same, you would expect, under López Obrador. This will be a tragedy of epic proportions if it comes to pass, and I fear you're right, it will, Todd Bensman. Let me go back to something you talked about a moment ago. You have a new book coming out, I'm very happy to say, in February, and we look forward to an hour conversation with you, if you'll indulge us when it's out, to talk about what you call America's Covert Border War: The Untold Story of the Nation's Battle to Prevent Jihadist Infiltration. And the termination of these restrictions on immigration from countries that simply cannot vet, or at least we cannot satisfactorily vet, people trying to get into this country from them, is a problem that is, as you say, more than just a problem of Sharia supremacists trying to get here, but it is a particularly serious problem with respect to that subset of this larger population. Talk a little bit about why this is of such concern to national security-minded professionals like yourself.
The countries on Trump's travel restrictions list are countries that have had no government, no intelligence systems, no civil authority to even provide birth certificates to its citizens. So the U.S. Adjudicators of visas are simply unable to vet who these people are coming from places that are filled and brimming with armed jihadist militias. And I'm like, think Libya for a minute, which is controlled by just a hodgepodge of, jihadist militias with a lot of blood on their hands. We don't know who is coming from, we're giving visas to. There's no, you can't call the Libyans for a background check on anybody. Same with Somalia, Yemen, Think Chad, right, which is filled with Boko Haram operatives. And Chad is not a government that is very, let's just say it doesn't have capacity to, you know, fill intelligence requests on the people that are, they don't even know who's operating there. It's a pre-modern country. Those are the kind of countries that are on Trump's travel ban, and eliminating that travel ban means bringing in people from those countries again in probably large numbers again without having any idea who they are. So they'll be completely unvetted. That's an unacceptable national security failing to not have something replacement.
It sure is. We have to leave it at that, Todd Bensman, for today. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope we will have frequent updates from you in all of these areas in the course of 2021. And again, thank you for taking this time with us in the very first days of the Biden administration and the beginning of the Biden effect on immigration. Next up, we'll speak with Ilan Berman about the Biden effect on Iran policy and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say, joined by a man we've enjoyed working with and talking to a lot over the years, but not recently, which I'm sorry to say is an error on our part, which we hope to remedy in 2021. His name is Ilan Berman. He is these days the senior vice president at the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington, and I believe widely regarded, certainly in Washington circles, and much more widely, as one of the real duty experts on national security in general and most of the challenges to our national security, whether it's Russia, whether it's communist China, whether it's North Korea, whether it's the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we wanted to get him on particularly to talk about how a new Biden-Harris administration is likely to interact with Iran, which is the subject of one of his most recent books, published last year, The Fight for Iran, Opposition Parties, Protests, and the Struggle for the Soul of a Nation. Ilan Berman, it's great to have you back. Welcome, and Happy New Year, such as it is.
Oh, same to you, and thanks for having me back.
You know, it's good to have a chance to visit. So, Ilan, President Biden has made it fairly clear in the course of the campaign, in his president-elect status, now I think in his opening days and his personnel choices of his administration, he really intends to throw over the side the Trump policy towards Iran, along with a lot of others, needless to say. Talk a little bit about what you think a Biden-Harris administration is likely to do with respect to the mullahs, and most especially their, I think, increasingly brazen bid to become the next nuclear weapons state.
Right. Well, listen, I think the writing's been on the wall for some time. I think even on the campaign trail, it was very clear that a Biden administration, if it came to power, would very much set the clock back 5 years and sort of go back into the confines of the 2015 nuclear agreement known as the JCPOA. I don't think that's a surprise. To me, the operative dynamic now that Biden has been inaugurated, now that we have a good sense of what his Iran-focused team really is, Secretary of State Tony Blinken, his deputy Wendy Sherman, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, is what is going to happen to legacy policy towards Iran? Because the Trump administration over the last 2 years has built a tremendous amount of economic and political leverage vis-a-vis the Islamic Republic. And that's leverage in the form of diplomatic censure, in the form of, you know, the chilling effects that U.S. sanctions have had on foreign corporations. That's all leverage that the Biden team can use against Tehran if they do go back into some sort of negotiations, which seems likely. The question is, will they?
And to me, that's really the operative question, because it's very clear from an empirical standpoint that maximum pressure against Iran has been working, that the Iranian economy is significantly weaker in economic terms, that Iranian society is significantly weaker in political terms. There's all sorts of signs of divisions and new rifts in civil society. And all of that can work to America's benefit, but only if we deftly use that leverage. If we simply uncritically go back to the 2015 framework, we run the risk of frittering all of that leverage away.
And it's not just leverage with respect to Iran. And it's, as I say, nuclear weapons ambitions. And more generally, it's terrorism, it's the efforts to dominate the Middle East. It's the implications of all of that for the region as well. And Ilan, one of the things I was struck by, Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States, wrote an interesting piece today, I believe it was, about the end of the Arab-Israeli conflict. He says it's simply no more. But I guess, as with the prognosis for Iran, that depends on whether we fritter away what we have seen accomplished during the Trump years. Do you agree? And how does the Iran uncertainty play into the broader region?
Well, no, I think Ambassador Oren is exactly right. And one of the remarkable shifts that we've seen over the last couple of years, and the thing that the Trump administration succeeded not in creating, but in nurturing and bringing out into the open, is this sort of rolling detente that's been happening between Israel and the Arab states of the Persian Gulf. And let's be clear, these are contacts that started, a decade, 12 years ago, as a result of common fears over Iran. But they've since blossomed into something much more. They blossomed into economic ties and political ties and cultural ties. And that is the new regional context that the Biden administration is walking into. And what it does with regard to Iran, if it's perceived as being too soft on Iran, if it's perceived as creating conditions that empower Iran and empower its regional malign regional behavior, that's going to have a lot of impact, not just on the tenor of relations between the U.S. and Iran, but also how the countries of the region view the United States and whether the United States, is a reliable ally, can be trusted, is a force multiplier, right? The stakes here are very big.
Especially to the extent that this is, of course, a region that has rarely known much tranquility. And to throw away the prospects for stability, this seemingly warm peace with Israel and a number of these Arab states, if not all of them, the diminution of the Palestinian conflict, at least for the moment, to say nothing of potentially really emboldening and intensifying the danger we're facing from Iran, would be, I would think, a blight on this administration, to say nothing of a grave disservice to U.S. vital interests as well as the rest of the world. Let me switch gears, if I could, quickly with you, Ilan Berman, to another of the areas of the world in which you are also deeply expert. You have written an important book entitled Implosion: The End of Russia and What It Means for America. I wonder if your feeling about what's happening at the moment is that is still in prospect, or is it likely that Putin, an old martial arts expert, is at the cusp of perhaps achieving something of a jujitsu against the United States under this new administration?
Well, it's interesting. I'm Russian. My family's Russian. And I actually spent the evening last night watching the Russian television takes on the Biden inaugural and President Trump's exit. And it was very clear to me from watching, new show after new show, that anybody who thought that the Russians preferred one side or the other, or the Russians felt favorably about one side or the other, really sort of, have missed the plot. The Russians tend to look at us antagonistically, no matter who happens to occupy the White House. But what we do towards Russia matters a great deal. And in here, I think what's happened in Russia over the last few days is remarkably important. And it's an opportunity, actually. It's an opening for the Biden administration to really sort of begin to think about Russia the way it actually is, not the way we wish it to be. And that's the return and subsequent imprisonment of Alexei Navalny, the opposition activist who you know, the paradox of all paradoxes is Navalny was back in the late summer, early fall, was poisoned by all accounts by Russian government agents on a flight in eastern Russia. He was rushed. He was allowed to leave the country. He was rushed for medical treatment in Germany, and he's been there until just a couple of days ago. In the course of that treatment, he missed a court date for a previous politically engineered show trial that he had been put on by the Kremlin. And because he missed that court date, when he returned back to Russia over the weekend, he was thrown in prison. And this really, I mean, it showcases a couple things, right? There's the usual outrage from Europe about, you know, human rights, which is frankly going to lead to nothing in terms of substantive action towards Russia. But it does show that there are cracks in the facade, maybe not the implosion that I wrote about, but it's very clear that there are people that Vladimir Putin fears. And there are people who are sort of super empowered personalities like Navalny that can really shine a spotlight on the deformities of the Kremlin regime, and they're not allowed to walk around freely. And this is frankly something that we should talk about, we should amplify, and we should weaponize.
It will be fascinating to watch this drama play out. And again, so much of it is up for grabs, it does seem to me. And I wish I had more confidence in the judgment of the president and his personnel choices with respect to Russia. But that concern actually pales by comparison to my misgivings about the team now running the United States government with respect to this other problem that we're facing. And I'd also like to pick your brains about it, namely the Chinese Communist Party and its agenda. Ilan, you've heard the reports of, you know, the Biden laptop and the evidence of not just Son Hunter's compromise, but Joe Biden himself by the Chinese Communist Party. What do you make of the implications of all of that for U.S. policy towards China?
So obviously, potentially very significant, but I'm a big believer in the idea that personnel is policy, which is why I listened sort of intently in general, but especially intently to this section of the confirmation hearing for incoming Secretary of State Tony Blinken with regard to China. And there was actually an interesting moment that gives me a little bit more hope than it does you, I think, which is the discussion of the last substantive act of the Trump administration with regard to China. On January 19th, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo formally designated China's clampdown on its Uyghur Muslim minority in Western China as a genocide under international law. And that was a enormously important moral, symbolic move, but it also has practical implications because international law is a two-way street and it creates all sorts of obligations internationally.
Ilan, I have to interrupt. We're hard out of time. We had a conversation about this with Gordon Chang earlier in the program, and I'm very pleased to hear your assessment as well. We will look forward to a further visit about this with you in the very near future, because all of these topics are going to be vitally important to the future security of our country. Thanks for your efforts to clarify them, as well as the great work you do at the American Foreign Policy Council. Ilan Berman, come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman about economic warfare and how that fits into the Biden-Harris program and our potential vulnerabilities. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome always to our friend and colleague Kevin Freeman, the proprietor of Economic War Room, a terrific television program on Blaze TV. You can find out how to get access to it at economicwarroom.com. He's the author of two terrific and best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and he is a senior fellow, very proud to say, of the Center for Security Policy, and a regular contributor to this program, for which we are also grateful. Kevin Freeman, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, we are now in the Biden administration, Kevin, and one of the things that I understand you have been worrying about intensively and have now devoted a forthcoming program of Economic War Room to is the prospect that Joe Biden's policies are going to accelerate a trend that seems to have been in the offing in the latter Trump years towards inflation, something we haven't really had to focus on much in recent years. Talk a little bit about the economic implications of an inflationary spell. What would be the impetus behind it, as you see it, under a Biden presidency, and its implications?
Yeah, Frank, let's be honest. The Trump administration did not have policies to prevent inflation. Of course, we didn't see much inflation at the time. My concern is it's been building, and it's been masked by COVID. And because COVID's been out there, it's not only masked the inflationary pressures, it's actually created an impetus for more inflation. And the Biden policies,
notably these stimulus packages in the trillions and trillions of dollars, right?
We've gone from $20 trillion to $30 trillion in debt in the blink of an eye. Now, it's not official $30 trillion yet, but we have $27.9 trillion of reported federal debt, which understates the actual amount our government owes. And then Biden talks about adding a $2 trillion stimulus. So you're at $30 trillion almost immediately.
And the implications of that, Kevin, are multiple, obviously, on the American people and what they have to purchase, and how far their money will go when they're trying to purchase it, but also the very value of the currency itself. This is a particular topic of concern from an economic warfare point of view, as you've helped us understand with respect to Chinese efforts, among others, to supplant the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. Remind us what the implications of that would be, point one and point two. Would another $2 trillion and inflationary upticks make that Chinese play more likely, more easily accomplished, do you think?
Yeah, well, let me start with the second question first. Just imagine right now we owe roughly $30 trillion. And our total interest, total amount that the federal government pays in interest is a little less than $400 billion a year. We're paying a little over 1% in interest on all that debt. Well, interest rates, you and I have been around long enough to know that interest rates aren't 1% is not normal historically over the long term. In fact, 6%, given this level of debt and the rapid pace that it's increasing, and with food price inflation and everything else, you know, when they say inflation is just 1%, they haven't been out to eat, they haven't been to a grocery store, they haven't filled their gas tank at the fueling station. Bottom line is inflation's much higher than that, and economists suggest that it could move, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6%. So let's use that number 6%, because that is a fairly normal interest rate if you have an inflationary environment. Well, guess what? If you're paying $400 billion on $30 trillion in debt now at little over 1%, you at 6% interest, you'll be paying $1.8 trillion in interest payments. That's more than half annually. That's more than half of what we take in taxes. It's more than we pay for national defense. It's more than we pay for welfare or Social Security or Medicare or any other item in the budget.
And more to the point, we won't be able to pay for those things in the budget if we have to have that much lopped off just to cover
the debt. We just have to borrow more. It creates a vicious debt cycle. And where do you borrow that money? You're going to borrow it either from the Federal Reserve, which is monetization, which is the path that Venezuela and Zimbabwe and others went down, and it ruined their currency and ruined their country. Or you're going to borrow it from China or someone else.
If they will lend it to you.
It puts them in a perfect economic warfare situation that they can refuse to lend it to you, and you can destroy your currency. And what happens then is if the currency, the only reason that the American dollar has been able to be sustained during this massive debt increase is because most of the people in the world want our currency. But China has been lobbying since 2013 at a minimum, and Russia since 2008 at a minimum, to have the world no longer take the dollar as the perfect reserve currency and the standard by which you measure other currencies, but to replace it with the Chinese renminbi or a basket of currencies or something else. If they convince the rest of the world with this huge increase of debt that they shouldn't take dollars, our country's over. Financially, economically, we have no country left. Who do we turn to borrow from?
Kevin Freeman, one of the other arguments that I've heard for why people want to hold our dollars or have their transactions, you know, denominated in them, is that we defend much of the rest of the world. If one of the other upshots of a Biden presidency is that we do less of that, if we're less capable of doing that, among other things, would that factor in as well to the Chinese bid to have others use their currency or some basket of currencies, as you say, as an alternative to the dollar?
Well, of course, and especially if we find that our interest payments are crowding out our ability to fund our Defense Department, because that's the first thing that gets cut. Every time the Democrats have control of both houses of Congress and the White House, and there's a budget issue, the first threat they make is to defense. And so they'll cut.
Not social spending, that's for sure.
Yeah. So the bottom line is, absolutely, this is a perfect play for the Chinese right now.
Which brings me to the topic of the program that you're running this week, as I understand it, on Economic War Room, which is essentially broadcasting an extraordinarily impressive program that was taped over the summer in Washington, D.C. Talk a little bit about the China Liberty Summit and what viewers to Economic War Room will take aboard if they tune in.
Well, Frank, that's a great point. It stands the test of time. I watched it. It was filmed in July, but it's pertinent today. We were editing it for the economic battle plan that we produce with every show. We had incredible guests, Gordon Chang and Rod Martin, and you were there, and Dave Bratt, and Eric Bowling. So we were discussing China's economic warfare plans and what they're doing with us, either in space. We had General Quast and others on video, what they were doing in space, but also what they're doing economically, what they're doing with trade policy, what they're doing with currency policy. This is a very aggressive regime that has full intent this century, perhaps by 2025, to become the dominant economic player and really the dominant player of all types in the world. And they're moving rapidly towards that. And they're being successful in so many areas. There were temporary stops during the Trump administration, things that we worked on regarding American investment in Chinese companies and so forth. But under a Biden administration, it looks like it's full steam ahead for the Chinese.
Unfortunately, and you know they've got to be emboldened because, among other things, they have in the role of Commander-in-Chief of the United States a man who they have deeply compromised over the years. There is evidence, as Trevor Loudon shared with us yesterday, that Kamala Harris, for that matter, is similarly compromised, perhaps not quite the same way, but by virtue of her longstanding ties to, Chinese communists, among others, in the San Francisco Democratic Party machine. So when you put all this together, looked at from your vantage point as one of the country's preeminent experts on economic warfare, Kevin Freeman, it looks as though the Chinese may well see this as a moment at which they could act aggressively, perhaps just, again, in the way they have it oftentimes to date in the economic arena, but perhaps kinetically as well. Very quickly, your thoughts on that?
Well, they feel like they've got all winds in their favor. And you can look at the Biden administration appointments, CIA or wherever, and you see connections to pro-China groups or even direct connections to the Chinese Communist Party. It really is a frightening situation to look at, and that is unfortunately where we find ourselves after having made so much progress exposing last year the Chinese corruption and influence here. This year it looks like they are on the offense.
Indeed it does. Kevin Freeman, we will be tracking it closely, as I know will you, at Economic War Room and at the Center for Security Policy. We're so appreciative of the time you spend with us each week and the work that you are doing. I know you'll keep it up, and we look forward to covering it with you. We look forward to talking to the rest of you about this and more tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.